This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/sword.
This podcast is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
I'm Veronica Belmont.
And I'm Tom Merritt.
And if my audio sounds a little funny tonight, that's because
she's reporting live from another planet.
That sounds way better than the story I had.
She moved to another planet.
Yeah, I moved and I haven't set up my whole podcasting station yet, so I'm on my regular like gaming headset. And for some reason it makes a noise every time I move my mouth. So
besides the noise you wanted to make, which would be the noise of your voice.
Exactly. So I'm going to let you do the brunt of the talking tonight. How about that?
Ah, finally. My dreams have come true. No.
So what's this story about Project Gutenberg?
So Project Gutenberg, if you've never heard of it, is a project to take all public domain works and digitize them. It has been around on the internet since, well, I know at least the early 90s. It may be older than that. I may be forgetting. But they have a ton of stuff. Charles Dickens, Jules Verne, things that are in the public domain, books that they've been taking. And first they made them available as text files. These days they make them available as ebooks. However, Greg Bear, along with a few other science fiction writers, including Astrid Anderson Bear, his wife, daughter of Poole Anderson, are a little angry with Project Gutenberg these days because some books that are from still living authors like Friedrich Poole and Jack Vance are showing up in Project Gutenberg as being in the public domain.
Mm-hmm. And so they're not getting paid for the works that are being distributed for free.
Yeah. So and they're not angry necessarily. They're just calling them on it. They say, in general, Project Gutenberg is doing a tremendous service by making available texts that have truly long since fallen out of copyright, but they're clearly overstepping their original mandate. They're not merely exploiting orphan works, but practicing a wholesale kidnapping of works that are under copyright protection. On the one hand, they respect Project Gutenberg. On the other, they're a little miffed.
Well, that's understandable. I mean, a lot of authors got pissed off by Google Books and them copying books and putting them online for free for anyone to read. And it's been a very interesting legal back and forth between projects like Project Gutenberg and Google Books and the authors who, you know, still may be around and still could potentially be paid for the works that they've done.
Then there's also things like Philip K. Dick or Lee Brackett who have passed on, but their works are not in the public domain and the estates of those people still hold the copyright up for them.
Mm-hmm. So what's your take on the matter? Do you just think there's a very defined line for when these things can go into the public domain?
Yeah, there is. I mean, orphaned works are a whole different matter. Orphaned works are when you don't know, is the author still alive? Did they register a copyright back when they were needed to be registered? There's questions. But a lot of these works are not orphaned works. If the author's still alive, in the modern day, you can pretty much assume that the copyright's still valid.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
I know, it's enough to give anyone a coughing fit.
Yeah, seriously. Oh, man, I don't know why I got a dry spot right then.
Well, you should be drinking whiskey.
And that's probably the problem. I'm drinking
water. That's probably definitely part of the problem.
So I don't know how Project Gutenberg messes up on these things. These seem fairly obvious. There's the famous Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act of 1998 that essentially keeps things in copyright for 70 years after the death of their author. So if somebody's still alive, you can pretty much assume it's not out of copyright. So did Project Gutenberg mess up? Yes, it sounds like they probably messed up, although I haven't really dug into it much farther than this blog posting. However, I do think copyright should not last so darn long to where it's you know, it's basically impossible for a work to go in the public domain these days. In fact, I'm not even certain that I agree that copyright should last through the life of the author in some cases. There have been plenty of studies done saying that economically and artistically speaking, what's beneficial for the world is a copyright term of about 14 years.
Yeah, but I bet the author who's put a lot of work into his book or his project would disagree with you on that.
Well, sure, and I see why. That's a it's sort of when you're talking about your own thing, you want to milk as much out of it as possible, and if it's very successful, you'd like your sons and your daughters and your family to benefit from it after you're gone. I totally understand that, but copyright law isn't meant to enrich people. Copyright law is meant to extend protection for innovation and artistic creation. And if these studies are right, by having a copyright law that is so long, you're actually restricting innovation. You're actually protecting, you're actually reducing the amount of art, and in some cases, de-emphasizing creation because people can't use the works of others to build on. And that is essential to being able to do certain types of art. Mashups, for example, are a good example in the music arena. So it's not such a big problem in writing as it is in other forms. So maybe different terms of copyright for different types of mediums, and maybe the life of an author is good for a book since you don't have as many problems with people, you know, wanting to take characters out, although there is such a thing as fan fiction. But I think our copyright laws are way, way too restrictive at this point.
I don't know why fan fiction isn't under fair use. Can you explain that?
Well, see, that's the whole thing, is that fair use is a really strange and barely codified legal principle in the United States, and you have to be willing to defend it in court if you want to avoid fines. And so it's not like you can say, oh no, I have a right to fair use, and it's, and you're done with it. You have to go to court. You have to pay to go to court. So even if it meets the four-factor test of fair use, if you're not rich enough to defend yourself in court, you're basically not going to bother. Because
it's very easy for people on the internet to just start screaming fair use.
Yeah. There's fair use in practice and fair use in theory. Fair use in theory does protect a lot of things, but you don't know if you're going to win in court, and it's going to cost you a lot to find out. So I've run in most of my corporate situations with companies, people saying, you know what, we don't want to risk it. It may be fair use, but we don't want to risk being taken to court over it. So we're not going to take that risk. So essentially, fair use becomes very limited in practicality. Fan fiction could be considered fair use. Fair use has to be transformative. You know, in other words, you have to change the work. You can't just copy the original work, which fan fiction would mostly
be. Well, yeah, that I don't think that's really an issue with fanfic.
You have to, you can't undermine the business model. You can't undermine the market for the work. Fan fiction could be argued both ways, right? It could be popularizing a work. On the other hand, it might be damaging to the trademark if it's really bad fan fiction.
Like some like Edward and Jacob love.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, maybe
I couldn't even think of a thing to say.
Maybe the Twilight
characters.
Right, maybe the Twilight franchise doesn't see that as a positive for their brand, and it undermines their market. So, and there's two other factors that you have to consider. And it's not like, oh, well, I fall under one, so I'm fair use. And it's not that you have to meet all four to be fair use. The courts, you know, interpret them very differently in different cases. Anyway, that's a very poor and very brief description of why fair use is not as easily done as
no,
it is said.
I don't
said.
Think it was a poor explanation.
No,
you
the lawyers in the audience
me every
know.
A few times every year, and I still have trouble grasping the various intricacies of copyright and fair use and trademark. And
right.
You hold a lot in your brain, Tom Merritt. But let's talk about some things that are definitely still under copyright. and are coming out in the next month.
That's right, because they haven't actually come out yet. So you can be sure these are protected by copyright.
Oh, yeah, big time.
Yeah, because they're coming out soon.
Let's see. We've got a lot of books, actually. A new Anne Rice novel of Love and Evil. This is her now coming back to her roots, because she kind of left her she went through a born-again phase, which is fine, and obviously I don't think that changed her writing too much, but now she has since denounced that whole way of life, so it'll be interesting to see how that carries over into her books.
That came out December 1st, so that's on bookstores now. In bookstores now. Mercedes Lackey also came out with Finding the Way, another Tales of Valdemar earlier this month. Another good one for a lot of folks in the audience here.
Oh, and then that George R. R. Martin book, Songs of the Dying Earth, is coming out on the 7th.
Or did come out on the 7th.
Oh, are we in the... Oh, yeah. This is still December, isn't it?
Yeah, it's December 20th.
I've lost track of this entire month. Really? Because my computer says it's the 13th. Explain that, Tom Merritt.
Time travel. We'll get to that when we start talking about Charles Yu. Joe Haldeman, we've read one of his books, one of his famous books, The Forever War. He came out with Starbound, this one is coming out in the future. It's so hard when you time travel. December 28th comes Joe Haldeman's new book, Starbound. So let's see if there's any other really interesting stuff. Futurama coming out on DVD.
Yay, new Comics Day.
Yeah.
On the every Wednesday.
Always a new Comics Day.
Mm-hmm. And Tron Legacy came out on the 17th. Hey, did you see it?
I did.
We should talk about that a little bit.
I enjoyed it.
I also enjoyed it.
I didn't love it the way I wanted to love it, but I had a good time watching it. It was like a big, fun music video.
Exactly. I thought it really did justice to the original. I thought it was what they would have wanted it to have been back in 1982. So it was nice to see that vision of the world come to life. I thought that was great. The one problem I really had was with the kind of uncanny valley nature of Clue. And I know they had to make Jeff Bridges look younger. I know they had to go back in those, you know, back in time scenes and kind of de-ageify him a little bit. But if they were going to do that, and if it was going to be to that extent, and it was very close. I mean, if people didn't know, they may not have noticed. You know, there's a possibility that someone may not have noticed that. But knowing it made me really notice it a lot more. And they should have made all the other programs have that little edge of Uncanny Valley to them, that little edge of not quite right, real.
He looked like a Flynn from a cutscene in the video game of Tron. And so that works when you see Jeff Bridges in the game universe. It doesn't work so much when he's in the real universe talking to his son at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, but do you see what I mean? Like, maybe they should have made some of the other characters have that...
Right, right.
...appearance, that veneer to their appearance would have been kind of interesting. Although, Olivia Wilde just looks fine just the way she is. So.
She does. She looks all right, huh?
Oh, yeah. She's just fine.
She does all right.
She does all right for herself, that Olivia Wilde. I loved her hair in that movie, man. Like, I've seen her, you know, she's on House, and she's gorgeous, gorgeous girl. But I love her short hair like that. I think she should have that haircut in real life.
Well,
not that I'm in any place to recommend, you know, famous people do their hair a certain way. But
welcome to Sword and Hairzor.
Hairzor.
Where we recommend hairstyles for people in science fiction movies.
That's terrible. But yeah, I enjoyed it. It was time well spent, I thought. I'm glad I went to go see it.
Also, coming out on Christmas Day for the first time ever in the United Kingdom and the United States at the same time, the Christmas episode of Doctor Who. Usually, I don't know if you folks in the UK realize this, the Doctor Who Christmas special in the past has come out in like April. Like, we just don't get it until they start the next season of Doctor Who. Oh. Last year, they actually aired it like 2 days later. So y'all got it first, but we actually did get it within the same week. This year, they're finally like, look, it's the internet, it's the world, everything comes out at once. You're just going to watch it. Everybody's going to get it on the same day. I don't think it's coming at the same time. That's okay. I understand that. But 6 o'clock Pacific time, 9 p.m. Eastern on BBC America here in the U.S., we actually get the Christmas episode of Doctor Who. I'm very excited.
Awesome. Very, very cool. All right. So now I think we should time to head on over to the Bear Your Sword section of the show. And the first thread that we're looking at is about discussing books for future consideration.
Yeah, Terp Kristen was not all that keen on how to live safely in a science fictional universe, but was looking into use other stuff and came across Lev Grossman's The Magicians, which
it's on my list of
she
things
thinks
to read
looks
already.
Pretty nifty.
Yeah, that would definitely be one. That was on one of the lists, I think, one of the IO9 lists recently. Push 2009. Maybe it was books of 2009 or best new books of 2009 last year, because I think I put that on my list of things to read. And yeah, I feel like we've been letting Terp Kristen down.
I'm sorry, Terp Kristen.
I don't think she's enjoyed the past couple of books.
All right, we got to do something about that. Although I like Alator's recommendation of Good Omens, Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman plus End of the World equals tons of fun.
Oh yeah. Did I read that? I feel like I read that.
Did you really?
I don't know. I can't remember now. And then we have Mauve 1976 recommended Red Mars and Altered Carbon.
I've read Altered Carbon. It's really good. Hardcore sci-fi,
Gibson,
but really
right?
good. No, it's Richard Morgan.
Oh, why did I think it was Gibson? Interesting. Oh, I have that book. Okay, we could do that. I actually own that book. Cool, I'm looking at the cover now, and I'm like, oh yeah, I've seen that before. I have so many books. I had to give away so many books when we moved. It was really depressing.
But, let's not forget, we can't let Terp Kristen down. Maybe the Magicians.
No.
But it's a little early for that, so keep the ideas coming. We'll keep kicking them around. Terp Kristen, if you want to look around at some of these other recommendations and make your own secondary recommendations.
Ooh, there's a lot of recos for Altered Carbon, so that might be something coming down the line.
It is a pretty good one, I have to admit.
Yeah, but you've read it already?
I have. It's sitting right over there. I'm looking at it right now.
Very cool. And then we have a really interesting thread that I got a kick out of by Nuke the Whales Again. Username Nuke the Whales Again started a thread called Similarities with Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And this has to do with the Charles Yu book that we're reading right now. And he says, I am still early on in the book, but I've already noticed some similarities and wondered if there were more. Thematically, both books are obviously very self-aware and quick to find humor of sci-fi trope. The main characters in both books travel in a device that works in a slightly confusing way.
Yeah.
And both are quick to point out how impossible it is to do everything in the book. Hitchhiker's Guide is my favorite book of all time, so I may be stretching here, but has anyone else found any similarities? And Terp said the computer / robots both have very depressive tendencies. Which
that's
is true.
The U robot at Time Machine is a lot less expressive. Mm-hmm. About the depression.
She's pretty emo, though.
Yeah. Well, that's what I said. I actually responded in this thread, and I was like, it's like he is the emo Douglas Adams. There hasn't been anything truly wacky in How to Live in a Science Fictional Universe. There's no Zaphod Beeblebrox type character. It's a little more maudlin. But I definitely get that sense that it'd be sort of, if Douglas Adams were not quite so trippy, if you like gave him some Depakote and it took down his highs and just
pardon the expression, if we brought him down to earth a little bit.
Yeah. Then I could see it. There's definitely an undercurrent that's similar to Adams. I get that.
Very cool. And then finally, this cracked me up. It was two-word reviews. No spoilers, by the way. This was started by Eric. And, you know, just two words. How do you describe science fictional universe thus far?
Mm.
His first pick was Nonsense Mishmash.
Ah, that's... one thing
doesn't
that
sound like a fan
here. I'm about halfway through right now. Even though I know we haven't officially kicked it off, this is sort of the kickoff episode, but whatever. I think it reminds me a little of Memoirs Found in a Bathtub.
You're not the only one to say that.
Yeah,
actually,
I was worried about that because I didn't know if you would. You weren't too keen on Memoirs Found in a Bathtub.
I see the similarities, and I'm also about halfway through. I'm liking it. I've had some actual laugh-out-loud moments. I'm not sucked into it yet, but that could also be because I was in the middle of reading Last Argument of Kings.
Mm-hmm.
By Joe Abercrombie. And so I was very, very emotionally involved in that world. We should talk about that, by the way.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's do that in our... We'll do a kickoff of Science Fictional Universe. Well, we're kind of doing that right now, essentially. So in that section, let's talk about what else we've been reading.
I said in this thread, Deep Thoughts.
deep thoughts is pretty good, actually, because it is. It's very much a comment on the human condition, if you want to put it that way. There's a really good article in Wired reviewing it that talked about how the author, he's actually the guy who does the Geek Dad blog over at Wired, Jonathan Liu, felt like it was hard to read in certain parts. It got a little stream of consciousness in part, but he loved the truth through the trope so much that it really captured him. The idea of the universe with the science fictional time machine, with the explanations of chronodiegetics, just are so well done, because if you read them closely, you realize that what he's saying actually isn't just gobbledygook. It actually is insight into how time works, and then that's pulled in with relationships of families and father and mother and depression and you know, what we want out of life and what we actually get out of life, that it's so intricately done that he really loves it. So I would recommend reading that review to get another perspective on it.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, Matthew said sad failure. Ooh.
I'm trying to think what I want to say.
And Allah said, meh, meh. That doesn't count. It's the same word.
I'm going to say slow realization. Mm. Because
right, we're kind of feeling it the same way.
Yeah, I feel like it's a slow burn. Like, it doesn't suck you in and drag you along like a George R. R. Martin, where you're just like, oh my gosh, I'm in a whole other world. And that's kind of what I expected, because it's a science fictional universe. But when you read it, it kind of slowly works on your mind, and you steep in it a little bit. And I think it hits me later, what I've read, in a bigger way than when I'm actually reading it.
All right. Well, as we mentioned, this is kind of a kickoff episode, and we'll have the link to the Wired article in the show notes. But maybe, should we talk about what else we're reading?
Yes. Let's first of all, because this is what I'm reading, thank Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks. They have more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature. They've got bestsellers. They've got the bestsellers from the New York Times. They've got the New York Times. They've got the Wall Street Journal. And listeners of this podcast get a free Audible audiobook to give you a chance to try out the service. This might be the perfect time to do it. If you've got a holiday break coming up and you're looking for something to fill the time, maybe you got some chores you want to do around the house. You think, well, this is kind of a waste to do chores around the house during the holidays. I do this all the time. I put an audiobook on and listen to it while I'm doing some sweeping or some cleaning, and then it's not even like I'm doing chores. I'm just reading a book and getting something done at the same time. So you get a free audiobook when you go to audiblepodcast.com/sword. I am in the middle of The Name of the Wind by Patrick Rothfuss, which I know we've recommended on this podcast before.
Numerous times,
but
yes.
I hadn't got around to it yet. And Audible was the perfect way for me to do this, because I'm reading How to Survive in a Science Fictional Universe as my reading when I sit down and read. But in the car and while cleaning, I've been listening to The Name of the Wind. And frankly, I've been finding reasons to listen to it when I'm not in a place where I need to listen to it, because that book has really captured me. So if you want to try it out, or you want to try another free book, go to audiblepodcast.com/sword. And that's the book I'm reading, The Name of the Wind. I was listening to it right up until you called me. I can't put it down.
It's a fabulous, fabulous book. And the next one's coming out soon. I can't wait to get my hands on it.
In March.
And he's just one of the best new writers out there right now. And I'm going to try to grab him for an interview at some point.
Oh, I would love to.
With the next book, and has all that wrapped up, and he's starting to do his press stuff.
Have you read his blog postings?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's got such a great voice, so different than the voice of that he writes in The Name of the Wind. The voice in his blog post is just so fun, geeky, and interesting that I would love to talk to him.
So how do they say his name? Do they say Kvothe? Kvothe?
It almost sounds like Kvothe, but it's a light Kvothe.
Interesting. Yeah. I wonder if he had any input on that. He must have told them how to say it.
I would hope so. I would hope that they checked with him, like, how do we say Kvothe?
That's a good question to ask any writers that we have on the show, actually, when they have to do their the Audible versions of their books. How much input do they have with the way things are said? I'm listening right now, for you Terry Pratchett fans out there. I started the Tiffany Aching series. And I got through the first book, The We Free Men, and now I'm on the second book in that series. And it is fantastic. really, really great stuff. So you've heard us talking about it on the show before. And if you have, you know, once you get through The Name of the Wind, pick up Tiffany Aching, because it's young adult, but it's not. It's really great.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. I just want to talk more about Name of the Wind. I'm so enamored with it. And it's so funny, is Scott Johnson told me how great it was. You told me how great it was. Plenty of other people were like, how can you not have read this yet? I have rarely had a situation where something is hyped so much and yet still surpasses the hype.
Yeah.
I can't explain what it is about the book that captured me so, but it's got all of it. It's a universe, a world that you like and you're interested in, and it makes sense and it sounds interesting. You're introduced right off the bat to the demonic, otherworldly element. You've got a central mystery around the person that the story revolves around that is incredibly compelling, and it's like the most interesting man in the world of this world.
Yes.
Right? Because he can do everything. Uh-huh. But he's also believable. He can do everything, but he's not superhero. It's like he doesn't do everything perfectly, he just does it really well, and the backstory really explains how he came about being able to do all these different things, which you don't get in superhero stories, usually. You don't get a believable backstory. It's like, well, you know, circumstances just sent him in these different areas where he learned these different tasks, and that's how he... It's just so well put together as a story.
Well, you know what else? I mean, it really is just... Ooh, sorry. There's like a really extended backstory. It's like a super long origin story. So you know, you kind of know how it turns out, but you don't know how things got that way.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what I like, that unraveling mystery.
You know, it's a little bit similar in How to Survive in a Science Fictional Universe, because he tells you right at the beginning, this is how I die, right?
Yeah.
But you don't know how he gets there. And it's somewhat similar where it's so funny in The Name of the Wind, and I don't want to do too much of a spoiler, but you think the mystery is one thing, and then that mystery is like, not resolved, but unveiled suddenly, and you're like, oh, that's not the mystery. They
right.
actually know that. And then, so how did we get to that? And that's what that whole backstory is. And when it takes that turn where he starts telling his own story, I was like, oh, but I really like this universe, and now I'm going to be going into this other backstory. I don't know if I'm going to like
oh,
this as
no,
much.
No.
It's 10 times better. It's incredible.
Well, what's really cool, and if people don't know this, this is meant to be a trilogy, and all three books are a different day that he is telling the story of his life. So each one is a full day, and then, you know, they break at the end of the evening, and then, you know, go on to the next day.
Yeah.
And so it's really just 3 days in time of him explaining how he became who he is. And it's really, really cool.
And then you just finished up Last Argument of Kings, eh?
Yes, I just finished the Joe Abercrombie trilogy. I'm not sure what they call that trilogy. It started with The Blade itself, and then Before They Are Hanged, and now finally The Last Argument of Kings. And loved it. I still don't know if I liked the ending.
The First Law trilogy is what it's called.
The First Law? Okay.
I think I know what you mean about the ending. It's a good ending, but it's not a wrapped ending.
No. I like closure.
Yeah.
That's just how I am with books.
And I like that universe so much that I also just missed it.
Mm-hmm.
When that story is over, and I didn't feel like I couldn't go back to it. It's like, well, no, the story's still going on, which is, on the one hand, the sign of a really good story, in that it's like, just like life, just like history, it continues to go on.
Don't you feel like it almost could have been a George R. R. Martin scenario, where it could have just kept going for a really long time? Like, I feel like it's the same, a similar kind of story in that there's not always going to be happy endings. The characters are endlessly engaging, and you want to keep reading about them. And there's just this huge world where so much can happen and so many different places you can go and you want to know about, that I could just keep reading these books forever, I feel like.
So,
but all good things come to an end.
And, exactly. And maybe Joe Abercrombie knew that he couldn't keep it up, or maybe he knew he'd get himself in a situation like George R. R. Martin, where people would be dying for the next book and it's taking a lot longer.
I think they're doing well, because it's a great series.
I haven't read Best Served Cold, which is his current book.
What's that?
That's out. It's not part of the First Law trilogy, but it's out now in mass market paperback. And then also coming out in hardcover in January 2011 is The Heroes. And The Heroes is over three bloody days of battle, the fate of the North will be decided. Best served cold, recommended by George R. R. Martin as a bloody and relentless epic of vengeance and obsession in the grand tradition. The battles are vivid and visceral, the action brutal, and the paced headlong.
If they say the North, that could be the North from the storyline. It's about Black Dow.
Yeah, it's the same universe, just not the same story.
I want to read that.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, Joe Abercrombie is handsome.
Is he now?
I'm looking at his author page on Goodreads.
Yeah.
New favorite author.
That's all it takes, huh?
No. Yeah.
Best Served Cold is also takes place in Styria, actually. So it's also part of that same world.
Good. So see, it didn't have to be over.
Yeah. And it's just rambling. It's ranging.
Good.
Maybe
That's
ranging
awesome.
Is
so
a better word than
you know other people will come back. Oh, and Felicia even rated it. She reviewed Best Served Cold. So good.
Excellent.
We've got people we know who have obviously enjoyed it.
All right, let's finish up with an email from Sean Smith, a.k.a. Zachlog the Great, who says, "Hi, Veronica and Tom. I was very excited when my friend told me about your show. I've been looking for a podcast about..." Yeah, I know. He says, "I've been looking for a podcast about written science fiction and had started to despair. We are, of course, awash in those discussing movies and TV, but as science fiction goes, that's a different animal altogether. So when my friend Chris told me about you, I was very happy, and so far, you have not disappointed. That said, I'm sure you get all kinds of book suggestions, but I just have to throw my two cents in here. Brandon Sanderson's Mistborn trilogy is an amazing set of books. His descriptions are precise and vivid, his characters are involving, and his plotting is stunningly intricate. I got to the end and was shocked looking at how well he had planned the whole thing, and how tiny things that have been present from the start became of amazing significance in unexpected ways. Since you've already had Mr. Sanderson on for an interview, I thought you might be receptive to this suggestion. I hope you pick this one soon, and if not, well, I'll probably still keep listening anyway."
Thanks, Sean. Well, that's awesome. That's really the mark of a great author, I think, is when you get to those situations where you find these little things that were stuck in somewhere, seemingly randomly, somewhere in the story, and then they come back later and you're like, "Oh, I knew that was going to be something," or, "Oh man, really that?"
You know who
it's such a cool way that people write, and I've never been able to figure out how they do that.
Who was a wizard about that was Douglas Adams, where he would throw away a joke, and you'd think, "Oh, it's just a throwaway joke." And then even like a book later in the Hitchhiker's trilogy, suddenly that thing would come back in a totally unexpected but perfect way and weave itself back in. And I read an interview with him where someone said, "How did you do this? How did you plan out all of these things that weave back in, weave in and out of your stories?" And Douglas is like, "Oh, I don't plan them at all." He's like, "I'm just as surprised as you are when they show back up when I'm writing. It's just all of a sudden, there's the, you know, the cow from the restaurant at the end of the universe. What's he doing here? Oh, well, he fits right in." I think some authors actually do plan that stuff out, but others it's just inspiration. It's pretty amazing.
That's brilliant. And then Craig wrote in and said, "About a month ago, I found fictfact.com, and he sent in a screen print. It tracks the series you're reading. Once you mark the book in the series you have read or are following, it sets up a list for the next book in the series. It will show a list of the books that will be released soon. They will email you if a book is added to a series you're following. You can sort your next books in any order you prefer. One other interesting thing, you can view your friends' books if they use fictfact as well. They just need to have a public profile." So it's kind of like, that'd be a cool feature that Goodreads, I think.
I was going to say, Goodreads needs to buy these people or buy their service or something. That would be so good to integrate. But this is fantastic. I'm totally going to sign up for this.
Yeah, so if you're having trouble figuring out what book comes next in a series, you know, if you're picking up a long series for the very first time, and, you know, I've done that so many times where I pick the first book in a series and there's like 14 books. And then I finish that one. I'm like, "All right, well, what's the next one?" And if they're not numbered, sometimes you have to go through the cover and flip around, see what order they print them in, or you have to go on Amazon and see what comes next. And it's just a giant pain in the butt. So that's a great service.
Thank you for that, Craig. Appreciate the tip off.
Totally, and thank you for listening. So, of course, we want to thank our other partner, StickerFoo. You can use the code SWORD1 and get 10% off the stickers at www.stickerfu.com. And if you want to send in some suggestions or tell us stuff that you've been reading lately, email us at theswordandlaser@gmail.com. The website, as always, is swordandlaser.com. And you can join in the discussion at goodreads.com. Just search for The Sword and Laser.
How to Survive in a Science Fictional Universe is officially kicked off. Go and keep reading, because most of you probably already started.
Time travelers, go!
We'll see you next time.
Bye, guys.